learning that we're discussing in the Parsha. First, I mentioned some of this last week. I just wanted to summarize some conclusions that we discussed that the miracle of Chanukah, the finding of the Pach HaShemen, did not occur at the time when the Chashmonaim were victorious over the Yavanim. In fact, the Chashmonaim were not victorious over the Yavanim and established an independent monarchy for another 25 years. So really, this was the middle of a skirmish, the middle of a civil war. What had happened is we had regained control of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. We were able to serve Hashem, but there was still a tremendous amount of Melchama going on for 25 years until the Malchus of Chashmonaim was established. According to most historical accounts, just to give you the dates again, the miracle of Chanukah happened in 165 before the Common Era, and it was not until 140 before the Common Era that Shimon was the last surviving son of Matisyahu, right? Yehuda HaMakabi, all these people had been killed, and Shimon was proclaimed by the Sanhedrin as the Nasi, as the head of the Jews, and a Jewish state was established. Now, what is important about that fact, why is that important? What's important about that fact is that this tells us very clearly that Chanukah was not supposed to be the Jewish 4th of July. Chanukah is not the day of our independence. And in fact, the day on which we regained our independence from Yavan is not even celebrated as a Yom Tov at all. Whatever that day was, 25 years in the future, was not celebrated as a Yom Tov. And it's very interesting to know why. Why was it not celebrated as Yom Tov? For a number of reasons. Reason number one is obvious, that there is no point in celebrating, at least in retrospect, there is no point in celebrating political independence, because that was very short-lived. The Malchus Chashmonai eventually collapsed, and it was conquered by Rome, so what are you celebrating? Meaning that we're not sure if maybe historically the first few years Chanukah did have that connotation as well, but in the course of time, in retrospect, the Chazal saw that there was no permanent benefit in that Malchus, and therefore we don't commemorate it. Number two, this is probably even more important, the Malchus Chashmonai eventually became the very thing it was rebelling against. That's a phenomenon of revolutions generally, of course. What was the famous work? I don't remember the author, but Anatomy of a Revolution. Makes the point that revolutionaries always become the very thing that they're trying to overthrow. French Revolution, etc. American Revolution actually might be an exception in some sense, but although some say it isn't. But the point is, the Chashmonaim rebelled against Yavan because Yavan was trying to destroy the distinctiveness of being a Jew, adopting a Hellenistic culture that glorified the body. Well, what happened was the Malchus Chashmonaim, although the first people were tzaddikim, eventually they became Hellenist. They didn't even have Jewish names, etc. And therefore Chazal saw in retrospect, what are you celebrating, the overthrow of Malchus Yavan, if the Chashmonaim became Malchus Yavan? Does it make a difference if we have a Greek kingdom that is a foreign kingdom, or a Greek kingdom that is a Jewish kingdom? Maybe a Greek kingdom that's a Jewish kingdom is even worse. So Mimola, they did not celebrate the Malchus Chashmonai because they became the Misgavnim themselves. The third reason why we don't commemorate the establishment of Malchus Chashmonai is, of course, the comments of the Ramban in Vayechi, where the Ramban points out on the Pasuk, Yaakov Avinu's bracha before he died was Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda, that the scepter of royalty and authority shall never depart from Yehuda. So I'm sure you know the Ramban's point, that this is Yaakov Avinu's bracha, that Malchus among the Jewish people shall always reside in Shevet Yehuda. David, of course, is the son of Yehuda. And therefore the Ramban says there was a special aveira, there was a sin in the Chashmonaim assuming the reins of Jewish monarchy, because it was a violation of Lo Yasur Shevet Yehuda. Now, we're not condemning Matisyahu and his sons, who led a rebellion because nobody else was willing to lead it. But the point the Ramban makes is, after peace was established, the Chashmonaim should have relinquished their Malchus, and they should have looked for a descendant of David HaMelech. And the Ramban says, and this is why we find that Malchus Chashmonai suffered a very ignominious end. In fact, we're told that Herod Hordas, who was originally a slave of the last kings of the Hasmonean, became a lackey, became a governor. Rome appointed him as governor and then king of Eretz Israel. And to ensure that he would not be reminded of his humble origins, he murdered all of the surviving people of the Hasmonean. Ad kidei kach, that the Gemara says, anybody who says they are descended from the Hasmonean, you know, is an Eved, is a slave, because the only leftovers were their slaves and their maidservants. There were no, and the Ramban says, all of them were killed out.
Didn't he marry Miriam?
Yes, he did.
That was before or after that he killed?
Well, the final murder was afterwards. I mean, that's when he wiped that. Well, basically, some historians say that he became so insane after she died that he murdered everybody. But the final killing out of the Hasmonean was afterwards. And, and therefore the Ramban says this was because of the Aveira of the Hasmonean. Not, again, they were not condemning Chas v'Shalom Matisyo or Vanav, but were condemning the later generations, who both became Hellenist and became obsessed with power, right? The old saying that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, applied to the Hasmonean, and they should have relinquished their malchus. The Ramban says another point, interesting, that very, very fascinating point. The Ramban says, in addition to the Aveira, that malchus belongs to Yehuda, which is one problem of the Aveira, he says there's a special Aveira, a separate Aveira, for a calling to be a Melech. In other words, if Reuven would have been Melech, that would have been an Aveira, but for a calling to be a Melech is a special, special Aveira. And it's very interesting, the Ramban seems to be articulating a separation of the church and state. In the sense, not as we would say in the United States, where we say we have separation of church and state to protect the state from the church, as a church and through the religion, rather it's the opposite. The Ramban says that the church, the religion, needs to be protected by not being involved in day-to-day political decision-making. And that is that a Kohen is supposed to be a teacher of Torah, and if a Kohen gets involved in power and gets involved in day-to-day decisions, the Negius, the self-interest in preserving power, can taint the purity of spiritual judgment that a Kohen has to bring.
So that's
right. Well, that's right. Rav Lechem, that lady, the Ramban said that's why a lady or a Kohen does not own land in Eretz Yisrael, that they shouldn't be involved in a material. Now, this has a direct relevance. I don't want to get into politics, but there are many people who feel that religious parties, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, although they've accomplished some good, there is a certain negative side to it, and that is at that point. People make decisions not based on principle and not based on pure Torah, but what will give them the most money, what will give them the most power, and the male of people make decisions, right? What does the Torah say? The Torah talks about a shochet. A shochet is a bribe. Yaver eidei chachamim. It blinds the eyes of the wise. Chavitz Chaim used to say that when it says a chacham, we can call a person a chacham who maybe is not really a chacham. But if Hashem calls somebody a chacham, the person must be a chacham. So if the Torah is meyed, right, Hashem knows. So if the Torah is meyed, if the Torah testifies, a shochad can blind even the eyes of someone that HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers to be a chacham. Then indeed you see how deep the koach of shochad is. Now shochad doesn't refer only to a dishonest situation where I bribe you to decide in favor of me, but shochad is a synonym really for self-interest. The profit you gain, where a person isn't even aware that their judgment has been taken. So the Ramban basically says there's a special aveira for a Kohen to be a Melech. A Kohen should not be a Melech. A Kohen should separate. And again, many people feel that if religion would be outside of the realm of politics, it would be a greater force for good. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
That's true. But again, the chiddush of the Ramban is that this is even true if you're talking about Kohanim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who are tzaddikim, etc., they can become corrupted. And indeed, the very sad story of Malchus Hashmonai bears that out. And of course, you know, when we say, for example, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of sinas chinam, hatred and polarization, historically, you know, there's besides the general illness, spiritual illness that existed, but if you remember the history of how did the Romans gain a foothold in Eretz Yisrael, there were various factions among the Hashmonaim that were fighting against each other. And one of them decided to enlist the Romans to come in and help them out. And of course, once you do that, you open up a box. So then that gave the Romans a foothold in Israel. So very, very literally, it was the hatred between brothers, very literally brothers, that resulted in Edom coming into Eretz Israel and eventually destroying the Beis HaMikdash. Just as a little digression, I'll get back to the Hanukkah thing very shortly. It's very interesting that in the book of the Maccabees, the Sefer HaMaccabim, we have the actual documents, or at least the language of the actual document, by which Shimon was proclaimed. Shimon was the last survivor as the king of a new Jewish state. And it's very interesting that the Lashon that was used is he was proclaimed as Nasi. Nasi means prince. And it says, until a Navi shall arise, until the time that Hashem shall give us back prophecy. Because remember, prophecy left at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. So I saw from Yaakov Kamenetsky that he actually had an interpretation of this, that this proclamation was written exactly not to be a violation of Halacha, that Shimon was not given the title of Melech, because he was a Kohen and not from Yehuda. And that's why he was only called Nasi. He was like acting governor, but he was not given the title of Melech. And the reason why the Chachamim put in the statement, until a Navi shall return, is because Eliyahu HaNavi is supposed to come back and inform us who is to be the Mashiach. So Rav Yaakov wants us to say that Shimon's designation as the first head of the Malchus was bedafka not a violation of Halacha, because the title Melech wasn't used, and it was stipulated, it was temporary until a Navi shall come and tell us Mashiach. But as I say, eventually what happened was that the title of Nasi was abandoned, they called themselves Melech, and there was no real thought about looking for a successor. But it's interesting that, at least initially, the generation was very sensitive to not to use that particular title. But just to digress for a moment about Malchus belonging to Yehuda, it's very, very interesting that if one had to pick, you know, it's a funny thing. I think we mentioned it last week or 2 weeks ago, but you know, Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. Yaakov showed favoritism to Yosef and later to Binyamin. And yet we find that in the history of the Jewish people, the Bnei Leah play a more significant role. First of all, they're much more numerous. But besides that point, the Melech comes from Yehuda, and Kahuna and Leviah comes from Shevet Levi. Bnei Yosef had the distinction of being the king over the 10 tribes, but if you recall, the Ramban actually says that the whole Malchus Yisrael, the whole kingdom of the 10 tribes, was against Halacha because the Malchus should have belonged to Yehuda. And yet, why is it that Yehuda is zocheh to Malchus more than Yosef? It's very, very clear that on one level, Bechor, right, that's why Yosef has 2 tribes, that the Pishnayim, the double portion that goes to a firstborn, Yaakov took away from Reuven and he gave to Yosef. Right? So Yosef had the status of a Bechor and yet not a Melech. So the Gemara in Yuma has a very fascinating comment. The Gemara in Yuma says, Ein Adam Nichnas L'Malchus, a person cannot merit to be a king, Ela Im Kein Kupa Shel Shiratzim Teluya Lo Me'acharef, unless he has, literally this means, a basket of dead rodents behind him. The English idiom would be skeletons in your closets. He has to have unsavory elements in his past. Kupa shel shiratzim. That's the phrase the Gemara uses. And it makes the point that if you look at Malchus Beis David, and in Yehuda also, you see all sorts of potentially unsavory, disturbing elements. Let's go back to Yehuda. The ancestor of David is Yehuda, and Yehuda was Mazana. Yehuda committed an act of prostitution with a woman that wound up to be his daughter-in-law, Tamar. And if you remember, Tamar conceived with twins, And one twin was called Peretz, he broke through, and one is called Zeref. And David is a direct descendant from Peretz, right? Peretz. So, in effect, David's is descended from Yehuda's promiscuous, I think there's no one else in the world, so they feel they have an obligation to perpetuate the human race. So Alok gets drunk, and one daughter is with him, and she names her son in a very unsinious way, Moav, which means from my father. The other daughter, the next night, does the same thing, and she eventually names her son Ammon, which means from my nation. Because of this, Chazal say, the younger daughter is marginally more tznius than the older daughter, so we treat Ammon a little better than Moab. But the point is that David comes on Yehuda's side from the Zenus of Yehuda and Tamar, and then he also comes from the Zenus that Lot had with his daughter, Moab. And then, of course, Rus herself came to Boaz in the guise of the middle of the night type of situation, which looks like a fairly improper thing, right? Because and also keep in mind that the Torah itself prohibits male Moabites from marrying into the Jewish faith, even if they convert. And you see over and over again that people constantly forgot the halacha that female Moabites are permitted, meaning people constantly raised the accusation of David that because he comes from Rus HaMoaviyah, he's not kosher to remain in the Jewish people, meaning there was always a cloud of this Moabite origin. Granted, halachically it wasn't a problem because female Moabites are permitted, if they convert, of course. But in terms of people's perception, people constantly thought that David HaMelech was illegitimate because he came from Rus HaMoaviyah. There's even an amazing medrash that actually says that for the first 28 years of David HaMelech's life, people thought he was a mamzer, including his own father. It's a kind of a complicated story. In other words, Yishai did not know he was David's father. Yishai thought his wife had committed adultery and David was born from an adulterous union. And the story that the Medrash says, it's kind of a complicated story, was Yishai was one of the tzaddikim who never sinned. We are told that Yishai, the Gemara has a lashon, Yishai died only because there was a snake in the world. Meaning to say, because of that Aveira that Adam and Chava committed, which makes death inevitable, that's why Yishai died. Yishai had no reason to die. There was no Aveira in his life. Now it's said that towards the end of his life, he began to look at his life and wonder if he had committed any Aveiras. And he came to the conclusion, perhaps, he wanted to be Machmir, that perhaps, since he is a grandson of Rus the Moabite, perhaps he's not permitted to marry a Jewish woman. He himself made the mistake. He had already been married to a Jewish woman, because since he's descended from the female Moabite, it's permitted. But he began to think, maybe I'm wrong. So he separated, after he had seven sons, he separated himself from his wife, and he took his Canaanite, his non-Jewish maidservant, he would be with, because he figured he'd be permitted to be with her because he's a Moabite. Now, again, we're back to the old switch. What happened was, I'm sorry? The Beis Din apparently kept on making a mistake. They also agreed with him at this point that it was Usher. It was forbidden for a descendant of a female Moabite to marry a Jewish woman. So he separated from his wife. He initiated a liaison with his Canaanite, his non-Jewish maidservant. His wife, in a replay of the Rachel Velea thing, his wife switched places with the Canaanite maidservant. He impregnated his wife, not knowing it was his wife, thinking it was a Canaanite maidservant. When his wife eventually gives birth to a child, he feels it is the product of adultery. Which of course is the same situation as Yehuda and Tamar as well, right? Yehuda's Tamar's pregnant. Okay? So for 28 years, David was raised in the belief that he was just the illegitimate, he was a mamzer, and he was not even Yishai's son. David didn't know Yishai's wife, didn't tell him.
Why didn't he bring up the sota?
Huh? Well, to bring for sota, there's a whole procedure. I mean, she has to be warned not to have yichud with somebody, etc. It's not very clear what her kavana was. Was her kavana that she knew the halacha? If she knew the halacha, if she knew the halakha, then she would have told him. I would have argued with him.
Sometimes it can be questioned who the father is, but it's never questioned who the mother is.
No, we know who the mother is. Well, okay.
Yeah, so why should he know?
No, the question is,
Yishai did not
know who his mother was.
Yes.
But his mother never disclosed that she had been with Yishai.
I see. Oh, that's a good
so point. So if Yishai figures he's separated from his wife and he sees his wife pregnant, his only conclusion is she must have committed adultery. You know, we don't subscribe to the Christian belief.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. That's what the that is exactly what the Medrash says. And the Medrash's source for this unusual story is that when Shmuel goes to Yishai and tells Yishai, bring me all of your children to see which one of them is deserving to be a melech. There were seven children and none of them were right. And then he asks Yishai, do you have another son? And Yishai says, well, there's somebody who's watching the sheep. You don't really know. And that is the point. That is the point in time in which Yishai and David first became aware that they were father and son. And this, the Medrash says, is the meaning of the pasuk, Evan Masu Habonim. Like David says in Hallel, the stone that the builders have thrown away and have discarded. Not worthy. Haisol Rosh Pina was the cornerstone. Now, why this was done is very, very much of a mystery. It might be a getter. You know, again, we don't know the spiritual compulsion that drove her to do this. It turned out that she was right, and it turned out that this is why David HaMelech was born, and Mashiach will come from that union. And yet, she did not tell Yishai, because Yishai's shita was that this was usher. The notion of trickery, of the wife tricking the husband for a higher purpose, is obviously something that's very, very pervasive. It's what... I'm just noting it. I'm just saying it's something that needs a lot of thoughts. With Rivka doing it to Yitzchak, and Tamar was not Yehuda's wife, but Tamar doing it to Yehuda, because remember, Yehuda was leaving Tamar a widow. And Tamar knew that was not the proper thing. Rus did not really do it to Boaz in that sense, but Rus certainly shocks Boaz into recognizing his duties by coming to him in the night, etc. And then Yishai's wife does it to Yishai.
Well, what about the children of Yishai? Wouldn't he have thought that his children wouldn't be able to be king, because they are also a result of a questionable alliance there?
Yes, but in a way, when Shmuel, that's true. In other words, Yishai's opinion now is that the alliance he had with his wife was improper because he was a Moabite. But Shmuel comes along and says, Hashem wants one of your kids. The problem with David is not merely that he's a mamzer. The problem with David is that he's not Yishai's son. So believes Yishai. So when Shmuel says, bring me your sons, Yishai's attitude is, all right, it's up to Shmuel to decide. I guess probably you tell him. But I'm not going to bring him David because David is not my son. See, you know, it's a different problem. You're right, there's going to be a psul on all of Yishai's children, but he feels David is not even his son. So, yeah.
I think it was you said at the beginning of this talk, when you said, you said an observation that out there, most times in the line of Malchus, there is some skeletons in the closet, or is there some kind of directive here?
Well, it doesn't say go out and sin,
I'll explain why,
but it does say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will choose for Malchus a line that has many problems.
And why?
Yeah, I'll get to that thing. I just want to establish the pattern.
Okay.
Now, there are a lot of reasons why this is given. I mean, one reason is given is this, that the goal of a melech, is considered to be a role model for people to follow, a leader, a spiritual teacher. And there is a concept that we learn much more from people who have been nichshel, people who have committed averos or near averos, and teach us the derech of tshuva, then we learn from someone who is too perfect to ever fail. This is why the Sfarim say Malchus was not given to Yosef. When Yosef is subjected to great temptation in Potiphar's house, Yosef just says no. when Yehuda is nichshol with Tamar, you know Yehuda is nichshol, but Yehuda can then do tshuva. The concept is that we look at people who have made mistakes and who had to do tshuva and reestablish their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is the greatest inspiration a person can have. I remember a footnote used to say, I think I mentioned this before, this was his criticism of Gedolim biographies. A woman once remarked, who had been reading all this genre, she says, it was so interesting that all of these people seem to have the same life. And she said it naively, just very cute. And you know, Shas at 4 and Shulchan Aruch at 5 and Kabbalah at 6. And Rav Putner said that we have to be makir, we have to recognize, and we don't have a lot of information in many cases, that these were children and adolescents, just as we are, and there were many struggles. You know, the Chafetz Chaim, perhaps when he was young, was not able, it was not easy for him not to speak Lashon Hara. It was something that took time and patience and work, and perhaps there were mistakes and setbacks, but what makes a gadol is the perseverance and courage to keep on and not to be discouraged by this. Yeah.
But isn't it also the necessary concept to answer the question of shochad l'satan, because
right.
It just doesn't, I mean,
well, I'll come, yeah.
It's great to learn to people who have failed and grown, but a pure tzaddik with that purity and that level of Morocco,
right.
Could also, in a way, be a tremendous leader.
Mm-hmm.
There's
got to
be more.
I'll come to that. I'm going to say a few different. I will go into that also. I just want to mention a few different perspectives. Yeah.
There's also a pattern here. All the imperfections are all in the sort of
procreative.
Every single time. And
that's right.
And also, Rabbi has a question about Shlomo also, eventually.
That's right.
Bathsheba.
Yeah.
Bathsheba tells him directly that Shlomo will be the Melech.
Right.
You know.
Yeshaya
and his wife, and then
Bathsheba,
it does seem to be that same imperfection.
Yeah,
I'll
get to that. We'll get to that in a second. In other words, but in a generic sense, the Mefarshim do say that there's a meaning of tshuva that you learn from failures that you don't necessarily see from successes. Even with Midas, like Rav Moshe used to talk about, people would remark on Rav Moshe never getting upset, never getting angry. And he would say this was not something he was born with, this was something that he had to work on. There's something very, very moving and impressive about the concept of struggling, that someone who struggles and works hard, that you don't have if somebody is just naturally. So that's why the ideas about, you know, emphasizing somebody's genius is maybe besides the point. We can look at somebody who knew Shas at 4:04, and we can say, oh, that's wonderful, but that is no shaykhus, that is no connection to me whatsoever. There is no lesson in that for my life or for my children. But we look at somebody, let's say, who had a bad temper and, you know, worked very hard to learn to be more compassionate, more understanding, and that's something you can say, gee, you know, maybe that's something I can try to do in my life. So on one level it's that. The other level is Al Pi Kabbalah, and in Kabbalah there are two ideas that are said here. One idea is that malchus, kingship, has to be an empty vessel that is there only to act as the conduit for the divine shefa. In other words, God puts influence and blessing into the world, and the melech is a conduit. And the way malchus is described, malchus is the tenth sphere, and it is said that the tenth is God, there are different manifestations, chesed, gevurah, etc. The tenth sphere is just a mixing bowl in which all the other influences go in. And the language is, Lesle migarme klum. Malchus has nothing of itself. It is just a conduit for the Shefa of Hashem. And that's why anava, humility, is the single most important essential for Malchus, And that's why the Kupa Shel Shuetzen keeps a person humble, or it should keep a person humble, and a sense that he is undeserving. And in fact, that is why David HaMelech's own life was not his own. Because one who has the Bechina of Malchus recognizes that everything in one's life is a gift. And that's the story, remember? Adam HaRisha should have lived 1,000 years, and he saw the neshama of David was only allotted 3 hours in this world. So Adam gave 70 years of his life so that David will live. And David apparently knew that. Meaning to say, David knew more than, of course it's true for all of us, but David felt it on an emotional level, that his life was not his own. He was living on borrowed time, as the expression goes. And that is part of the idea of the Malchus, in which one is just a conduit for the will of Hashem. There is no ego involved. There is no, it's like the ego in the brain is a mechitza, it really is. It's like a barrier. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends us, you know, messages and brachos and influences, but our own personal, you know, desires block it, and we don't receive the message, or it gets distorted. Ideally, one should try to be a clear receiver and transmitter without any static, which is why, in fact, the Drasha Saran says, interestingly enough, that this is why Moshe Rabbeinu was a stutterer. I mean, we know the Medrash, he was a stutterer because he burnt his tongue. But why did Hashem make it? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in other words, Moshe naturally was not a charismatic speaker. He couldn't speak well. It was only, in other words, if you'd have a, I don't know if Moshe Rabbeinu ever had a casual conversation, we can't say that he did, but if Moshe Rabbeinu was not communicating Torah, you couldn't really talk to him. I mean, the Ran says his stuttering was so severe that, I think the Ran says, and he makes a cheshbon, that 12 out of the 24 letters of the alphabet he couldn't pronounce. I mean, he couldn't talk. I mean, there's a severe speech impediment. So in effect, it was only when he said the words of Torah that there was no problem. Right? There are stutterers. He can sing without stuttering. Moshe could say Torah without stuttering, because at that point it was Hashem. But it was the word of Hashem. It wasn't the personality. In fact, that's the nafkamina between Moshe and other Nevi'im. Only Moshe achieved, we talk about energy-efficient machines. In other words, Moshe achieved a 100% conversion, meaning everything that Hashem gave him, he gave out. Now, other Nevi'im did not achieve that. Other Nevi'im, and that's why we say, Chazal say, Ein Shnei Nevi'im Misnavnim B'Signon Echad. Nevi'im, in other words, a Navi communicates a message with a tint. A certain personality will say Hashem's message this way. A certain personality will say Hashem's message this way. Because, you see, when we say the Book of Nach, and this is what Abinel says, a Book of Nach is not God's words, word for word for word for word. Rather, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives the Navi images and pictures which the Navi then writes down in their own words. So a prophecy is an expression of the individual personality of the Navi. Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy is not, because Moshe Rabbeinu is the only Navi where Hashem gave Moshe the exact words. And that's a level of clarity. See, we like to say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but that's not entirely the case. If in other words, if you're given a picture, if I'm trying to communicate to you by picture, it's a little equivocal. What is the message, right? I show you somebody getting out of a car in front of a house. Right? I'll give you a psychological, a Rorschach or something like that. So, well, does that mean somebody's leaving, somebody's coming? Is that a friendship, or is there a divorce going on? In other words, you don't know exactly. If I tell you, if I give you the caption, then you know. So the milah of Moshe Rabbeinu is that he was such a kli who could receive Hashem without it being distorted by any elements of his personality. And that is what is called aspaklaria hameira, a clear lens. It was still a lens, because even Moshe was not a Kadosh Baruch Hu. There's a lens, there's a glass between Hashem and Moshe Rabbeinu, but it's a clear glass, it's not a smoke glass. Now, what was Moshe Rabbeinu's quality, of course? Another, right? Because when you're not filled with yourself, So then you're clear in your perception. Which is why anava, in fact, it's brought down very, very much. Anava is not really modesty in the sense of the false modesty. Anava is truth. Because in truth, in other words, a person looks at themselves truly. One knows the goodness, and one knows the problem, and one focuses on the reality. So when you're attuned to reality, you're more attuned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the second perspective of, so again, I've offered two perspectives so far. One is that the Kupa Shel Shiratzim is a role model type of idea. The second is it's an inculcation of Anava. Now here though there's a very interesting paradox. If you remember Shaul HaMelech, when Shaul was commanded to kill Amalek, and when Shaul fails to carry out that duty, Shaul says, I didn't kill the king of Amalek because the people didn't want me to do it. So Shmuel criticizes Shaul for being too modest.
Mm-hmm.
He tells Shaul, Im katan ata b'yeinecha, you might think you're very small and insignificant in your eyes, but you are the head and you must take authority. Which means, in a way, it's paradoxical. We're talking about Malchus Beis David as being the sign of Anava, modesty, humility, and yet that was the failure of Shaul. It was almost a too much of humility. The answer is, once again, that the true humility is that one is makir, that they're nothing as compared to the Ribono Shel Olam, and one recognizes whatever they're given are gifts to be used for God. At the same time, one does what has to be done. One does not allow the humility to shade into failure to act. It is said about Rabbi Gedolim, Chafetz Chaim, who was, again, one of the most humble of men, that when he had to do something and take a stand and make a proclamation, he did it because he was doing it for Hashem's business. In fact, the real definition of modesty, humility, is not that you think of yourself poorly, which is not right, because after all, why should we praise delusion? What, Moshe Rabbeinu thought of himself as an ignoramus? I mean, is that something to praise? That's psychotic. I mean, that wouldn't be normal. Rather, the real definition of anava is you're not thinking about yourself one way or the other. So it's, you're not thinking you're great, you're not thinking you're bad. You don't think about yourself. You look at what has to be done in this world. You look at what the Ribono Shel Olam wants you to do, and you do it. In other words, it's not a question of. In other words, you're not because the person that is always thinking of themselves, whether they think that they're great or whether they think that they're awful, is nonetheless ego obsessed. You're obsessed with every time you do something. Does that put me higher on the scale, or does that put me lower on the scale? So people who are depressed will always rank themselves lower on the scale, and people who are arrogant may rank themselves higher on the scale, although arrogant and depressed are very close very often, because arrogance is a compensatory mechanism. But the true anava does not think of life in those terms at all. You just look at what needs to be done, and you do it. And therefore, the anav can be very aggressive when it's necessary, can be very activist when it's necessary, and when it's not necessary, they're not. The anav gets great satisfaction in the good things that they do, but they also get great satisfaction in the good things other people do. That's actually a test. Again, it's a theoretical test of anava, is you get the same joy when somebody else does a mitzvah as you do when you get the mitzvah. You should certainly have a great joy. Gee, I'm so happy I did this wonderful thing. But if the ultimate goal is to serve Ribono Shel Olam, you should also be happy if someone else does the wonderful thing. Now, it's interesting. I notice this with children sometimes, and I'm very amazed with it, because I think we adults lose it as we get on. But sometimes you have a child who gets home and is very excited about, like, how somebody else in the class won first prize or something. And that's enormously impressive to me, because, you know... We feel a little bad, like, you know, why didn't I get first? But it's like the same enthusiasm as if they had done it themselves. Now, unfortunately, kids lose it as they get older, because they become more competitive in that way. But there is a sense in which a child can sometimes be as happy about a friend getting something as they would be happy. And that's really the sign of another.
I have them understand that sometimes in certain places. based on this concept of that being just an Arnav and,
right.
And self-humble and, you know, with Adam, he's like, you're very pleased with him when he says, you know, Hashem smite your enemy,
yep.
And that's fine. But then yep. There are other places in him where he says, Hashem smite my enemy,
mm-hmm.
And make me great so that they should see that I'm really great and mm-hmm. I'm not as cool as they thought I was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It must mean something other than what I think it means.
No, but see, that's the whole point. If one has the false type of modesty, which, you know, one walks around with their head always, you know, looking down, etc., you know, they tell a story about, it's an old Hasidic story about how Chassid once at a show, how the Misnagdim were filled with false modesty. So he came into a Shul Simchas Torah, and they were giving out hakafas. So he announced, this hakafa is only for the humble people in the show. And then, of course, there's a whole fight. People are fighting.
Who's more humble?
You know, who's more humble? Or they tell a story about two yeshiva boys who were in a train, and they were each one was saying, I'm dirt and I'm nothing, and I have so many aveiros. And each one, oh, I'm even worse. And then there's a balabas who starts crying. And he says, oh, if these Beitoya are so worthless, I'm even more worthless. So they look at him and say, look who thinks he's worthless, you know. So, but the concept is this. If you're truly a humble person, and you truly devote every essence of your life to Ribbono Shel Olam, and you know that if you're given a greatness, you can be magdil the name of Hashem, then you can turn to Hashem and say, give me power, give me greatness, give me rulership, because I can be Makadish your name that way. Well, who are the enemies? Look, David HaMelech says, Halal Misanecha Hashem Esna. In other words, David says, your enemies, the Ribbono Shel Olam, are my enemies. And when David says, smite my enemies, he has identified elsewhere that his enemies are the enemies of the Ribbono Shel Olam. In other words, he has so identified, he's merged, he has identified himself with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goal that he can talk about my enemies, my friends, and he's referring to a kind of book like Pirkei Avos says, Asei Ritzono Kirtzonecha, make Hashem's will your will. And that is the merger, that is the what David HaMelech accomplished.
When he was made a base in London, the Balabatim came to pick him up for the Haftarah, and he told that himself to my husband. He said, they came to pick me up in this beautiful museum, and they are getting into the car. And I told them, I'm sure this, here's been by their own.
That's right. I mean, Rav Avramsky was a good example of this. Rav Avramsky was a great great tzaddik and gadol. He was nifter in 1968. And he had a style in which he was very meticulous about demanding that proper kavod be showed him. But it was not because he was a very humble person. But he's recognized that he represented something that people had to respect. Now, different people have different styles in that regard. But that is the concept of demanding the kavod, not because of you, but demanding the kavod because it is kavod of Ribbono Shel Olam. It's very hard. A Rebbe sometimes, say a ninth grade Rebbe, if kids, let's say in Israel, where kids may come from day schools or other schools where the custom of standing up, or the custom, the din of standing up was not widely followed. So a Rebbe has to come in and tell the kids, when I walk into the room, you have to stand up for me. Now, you know, for a humble person, that's not an easy thing to say, but I remember my Rebbe, you know, had to say, because this was an Indian of Kavod HaTorah. So it's a separate thing. So you separate the ego from it. Now, there is a shochad involved. There's a bribery involved, that sometimes a person may get infatuated with the Kavod, and it turns into a bad thing, which is why some Gedolim adopted an Hanhaga in their life where they would not pursue any vestige of even external honor, because they thought it was a poison. In fact, the Chafetz Chaim used to say that kavod was the greatest poison, because kavod is spiritual as opposed to what money, which is material. Chafetz Chaim says the wealth you get in this world doesn't really take away from Olam Haba, because physical things cannot be compensation for spiritual things. But glory is a spiritual idea, and therefore glory could take away a little bit. But the Chafetz Chaim, whenever he'd be on a trip and the train would stop at stations, it was an amazing thing. There used to be hundreds and hundreds of Jews who would gather at a train station. Imagine this.
Chavetz Chaim on the train, and he used to go out and just, they would want him to step out on the train and say hello and give him shalom for 10 minutes or whatever it was. So there was a time that Chavetz Chaim didn't want to do it, because he says, you know, people come mechabit me, I get covered, it takes away from my olam haba. So somebody told Chavetz Chaim, you know, listen, there are 500 Jews who are eagerly waiting to see you. Aren't you willing to do something for them? So he says, you know, to do a chesed to 500 Jews, I can give up even some of my olam haba, that much I can do. I'll do it for them. So that's the idea. So that's the idea of anava, of humility, of being a receptacle. And that's why Malchus in Kabbalah is identified as the Svira, as the manifestation of God's divine presence that has no content at all other than receiving all that comes before. Because you know, anava is especially needed because a Jewish melech has extraordinary powers. A Jewish melech can confiscate property, can kill people without court, going to court. So when you have all of that power, without the anava, it's not going to be exercised properly. So that's the other idea of Kupa Shel Shuratzi. The third idea was already mentioned by people here, and this again is based on the Zohar, which talks about, and this is why it's all the Avodas are connected to reproduction and procreation. This is called the principle of Shochad L'Satan, which is, again, a difficult idea to understand fully, a bribe to the Satan. A bribe to the Satan. Meaning to say that we know that Hashem created the world in which there is always the potential for evil. There is always a free will between good and evil. And therefore, there are kochos of tuma, there are powers of impurity in the world that are there to lead human beings astray. I mean, essentially, the principle of Bechira posits that in the world there are forces for good, forces for evil, and the human being has to struggle and decide in one way or the other. But the Zohar says, the stronger the Kedusha in the world, because there always has to be a balance. God cannot make it too easy. Right? If you'd have a world where every time you do a mitzvah you get $1 million in do that. So the Eibishter has to create a world where the choices greater the powers of evil are going to try to prevent that holiness from coming forth. And therefore the concept is that the powers of evil have to be distracted in some way into thinking that something that's really good isn't so good. Meaning to say, the Hashkacha, Yehuda had to marry Tamar because that would have been the holy union that would have resulted in the Malchus Beis Dovid. That the powers of evil wouldn't have allowed that to take place. But when Yehuda meets Zona, the powers of evil don't fight back. Oh, Zona, okay, let him do that. That's okay. That's a sin. And that's what's called the Shochad L'Satan, meaning something that looks in the guise of an evil at some point distracts the Kofo Satoma to allow the goodness to come forward. That's the idea of Rus and Boaz, that's the idea of Amun and Moab, that the Genesis had to be through incest, adultery, prostitution, etc., because that would be the only Pesach in which the only Pesach through which holiness comes into the world. So that the idea of a shochad was satan. Now there's yet another concept in Malchus Beis Dovid, which also goes back to the Kupa Shel Shuatzim. That is, all the Rishonim ask this question. Shaul HaMelech does one Aveira. The one Aveira that Shaul does is, he fails to kill Amalek, or the king of Amalek. So he's fired, he loses his job. And David does a tremendous Aveira with David and Bathsheba. And although David suffered tremendously, he lost a child, etc., and Avshalom, the whole rebellion, with a consequence of that, but David's Malchus remains intact. How come David is given a second chance and Shaul is not given a second chance. And there are many, many answers that are given here. One answer that's given is by the Sefer HaYikarim, which is a very interesting political. Sefer HaYikarim was written in the 1200s, but he gives an answer that is mamish relevant to the American political elections of 1996. And he says the following. He says that Shaul's failure was a failure in carrying out his responsibilities as heading a government. He was given a royal command to destroy Amalek. He failed to carry out the responsibilities of his office. As a result, he gets removed. David's failure was a personal moral failure. He had a taiva for an ancient station. Of course, we know Chazal tell us Bathsheba was actually divorced, etc. But the but there still was a taiva, because as you know, what happened was soldiers would always give their wives gittin. But the understanding, when they went to war, in case they'd be missing in action, but the understanding was that the soldier would remarry. David interfered with that understanding because of his passion. So it wasn't adultery, but it's considered to be a taiva for a woman who rightfully was waiting for another man. So the Sefer HaYikarim says this chiddush: personal moral failure is not necessarily a disqualification for a governmental office. It is only failure to carry out the responsibility of the office. Okay. All right. So that you can draw your own conclusion from that explanation. But other Rishonim give a very different answer. Other Rishonim, yeah.
But that's the assumption that with a person tomorrow failing, they will be
tshuva. And then you're very right. What we're saying is tshuva. Right, yeah, that's an important addition. Tshuva is possible for a personal failing, but it may not be possible for a failure to carry out the responsibilities of the job. But you're correct.
I've never researched this extensively, yeah. But it always seems to me
Although it's interesting, it's very interesting, because although it seems to be from Shmuel's Tochacha that perhaps Shaul was a victim of his humility when Shaul said, "I'm listening to the people," and Shmuel gave him Tochacha, katan im katan atavi yonecha, right? In other words, it almost seems to be the opposite, that you let your humility subvert your submission to the Ribbono Shel Olam.
In other words,
That's right, and that may be the downside of humility. In other words, the downside, the negative aspect of humility, is that one does not have a strong sense of one's ultimate inner core. Okay, again, we can't fully analyze this, but
right.
that's in other words, Shaul was clearly subject to pressures from the outside, as opposed to having that leadership which he could project.
And you see that same characteristic continues, like as David becomes more well-liked, or people start to notice him, he becomes like consumed with jealousy. And so it's the same characteristic. He's like in competition. Like you were saying before, he's not the kind of person who can feel happy when somebody else is getting recognition.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to say one thing about Shaul, that, indeed, Shaul is considered to be Mashiach Hashem, he's the anointed of Hashem, and, very, very great beyond our estimation. But in terms of what the facets that we can perceive that there was obviously a chisomim there in that way. So it may have been the negative side, it may be the dark side of humility. The dark side of humility, in other words, David's humility can allow him to assert and do what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants, even if it's unpopular. Shaul's anava did not allow him to make that step. Now, the other reason that's given why Shaul is not given a second chance is not because Shaul's sin is worse than David's sin, which is what the Sefer Yikarim says, but rather the difference is how do they respond. When Shaul is confronted with the Aveira, so Shaul's idea is to pass the buck. Shaul does it a few times. First of all, Shaul denies it. Shaul says, what do you mean? I took care of all the sheep. I killed everybody. Not the sheep. I took care of all the Amalekim. And then Shmuel says, what about the sheep? Oh, the sheep. The sheep is for Korbanos. He says, and what about Agag? He says, oh, well, the people, you know, I was worried about the people. And in other words, there's a constant notion of either diverting attention from it, denying it, trying to paint it in good pictures, and if that doesn't work, blaming somebody else. When Nasan HaNavi goes into David and confronts David, you know, the famous mashal, the famous parable about the poor man and the rich man, and the poor man had only one little sheep, and the rich man took the sheep and killed it and ate it. What should happen to this rich man? And David says, such a person deserves to die. And Nasan says to him, Atah HaIsh, you are the man. You are the man. And there's only one word David says, Chatasi. I have sinned. There is no excuse. There is no blame. There is no notion somebody made me do it. There is no taina. He could have said, for example, well, why is Bathsheba, you know, doing it? Nowhere I can see, you know. He could have said something. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't say anything. And even the killing of Uriah HaChiti was halachically justified, right? Because Uriah, we are told, was sent to the front, but he had disobeyed a royal order. He was a Morid B'Malchus. Bathsheba had a get. David could have come up with all the excuses in the world. But he realized that in Hashem's eyes, he didn't have an excuse. And he accepted it. And this midah of owning up to failure is exactly the midah that was exemplified in Yehuda. That when Tamar doesn't want to give away Yehuda's identity. She says to the man who gave me these things, and the Gemara makes the point that if Yehuda wouldn't have admitted, she would have been executed, she would have been burnt. And from here the Gemara derives the principle, it is better to better to throw yourself into a fire before you humiliate somebody. And Yehuda says, Sadkan Yimani, she is more righteous than I. So this concept of the capacity that Yehuda also comes, again, although the Torah indicates Leah called her son Yehuda because of gratitude, but Yehuda also comes from the word to be moda, to confess, to acknowledge. And that goes back to Anava. That's another facet of Anava. True Anava is the willingness to acknowledge the mistake and to take responsibility for the mistake and not to blame others and not to pay. Because all of us in our lives, we have an infinite number of people that we can blame all sorts of things for. But the ultimate test of a melech is the one Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. That's the concept that you have to assume the responsibility. What was Nixon's line? He takes the responsibility, not the blame. Yeah.
Why then does it say, I guess it's in the Gemara, that a woman is not happy until she has a son, because then she has something to blame the broken pot, you know, for blame.
Yeah, I don't remember that, because I like to be I don't remember that, but that's very... Uh-huh. So why Rachel wanted to do Da'im, so she'd have somebody to blame for the pot. Well, you know, it's human nature. It's human nature. We all, we all do that. But nevertheless, the ultimate malchus is not to do that. The ultimate malchus is to recognize your responsibility. So that's the other idea. Now, let me just mention, backtrack a second about Yehuda. So one aspect of Yehuda, and this was Nishrash. This was a midah that was Nishrash in Yehuda and in Malchus based on it. The concept of recognizing mistake, recognizing error. We even see it by Mechiras Yosef. You know, when Yehuda was the one that originally, Yehuda was the one who had the idea to sell Yosef, and the other brothers wanted to kill him. But, you know, Yehuda, L'chol HaPacha, said, let's sell him instead, like Reuben. Reuben said, throw him in the pit, because Reuben wanted to retrieve him later. Yehuda didn't know what Reuben's thought was. Yehuda said, let's sell him instead of spilling his blood. But you see that later it's Yehuda that's willing to say, in effect, that I will give my life, he tells to Yaakov, that I will give up my Olam Haba
if I don't bring Binyamin back safely. And the Yehuda is willing to recognize that what he had done was a tremendous abeira, and he wants to be mesaken it, and he takes the responsibility for Binyamin's safe return. So this is a midah of enormous importance in Malchus. I mean, even from a political, secular perspective, Kal v'chomer from the Lichnius, the notion of a melech saying, you know, I am responsible, I'm not going to look for other people to blame. I will admit when I'm wrong, and I will correct my mistakes to the best of my ability. I mean, it's a tremendously important midah for a melech to have. And this was the Malchus based of it. Now the other aspect of Yehuda, to go backwards a little bit, when we talked about humility, true humility, is also correlated with gratitude. Because when a person is arrogant, there's nothing; they're never grateful because everything they have is only part of what they deserve more, right? When there's true humility, then one is grateful for whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them. And this too, of course, is built into the very name of Yehuda, and this is why Leah called him Yehuda. This is recorded in the Torah, Hapam Odes Hashem. Rashi explains what's the circumstance that Leah knew, right? Leah knows Yaakov has four wives, and she knows Baruch HaKodesh, they're going to be 12 boys, so she figures each wife gets three boys. So the first three coming to her, she's not grateful. The fourth is HaKoras HaTov. Now I am grateful. Why? The key is Noipalti Yeser Al Chelki. If I have taken more than I deserve, that is what gratitude is. Gratitude is the sense I got more than I deserve. And the Sfas Emes says very beautifully, why are the Jewish people, why are we called Yehudim? After all, Yehudi is only Shevet Yehuda. Now the word Yehudim is usually not used in Tanakh. Usually Tanakh uses B'nai Yisrael. But for example, in the late Svarim, in Megillas Esther, the Jewish people are called Yehudim. Why Yehudim? Now the simple reason is because after the exile of the Aseret HaShevetim, all you had was Yehuda, Binyamin, and Kohanim and Levim, so Yehuda was the dominant tribe. But the Sfas Emes says, a Jew is called a Yehudi because every Jew has to go through life with the feeling of Leah calling her son Yehuda, I have gotten more from Hashem than is coming to me. That's HaKoras HaTov. Nataldi Yeser El Chelki. So Yehuda therefore connotes both gratitude and confession, the ability to take responsibility. Yeah.
Shouldn't she have been grateful for that first one even? I mean, didn't she give the opportunity to mother someone in B'nai Israel? I mean, you see that in the end it wasn't three each. That was, you know, both something on her part.
Well,
I
don't think the suggestion of the name was that Leah was not grateful. And after all, even Reuven, I mean, she says, now Hashem has seen my suffering, etc. But it means that the extra phrase, Hoda'ah is a special level of HaKoras HaTov, which is the recognition that I don't deserve it. That doesn't mean there can't be gratitude of a different level or another level before that point, which is, by the way, Hanukkah is called Days of Hallel V'Hodah. Al-Hanisim is called Hodah, which is the gratitude for that which we don't deserve, and that's part of the feeling of Hanukkah. In fact, the Mefarshim say that the whole miracle of Hanukkah is a matnas chinam, is something that we didn't deserve and we didn't even need, because the halacha is, if you find oil, right, you only have one day of pure oil. Let's assume Hashem wouldn't have made a miracle. So the next day, how are they going to light the menorah? They light the menorah with impure oil. The halacha is, for a communal offering, you're allowed to use tamei oil. You don't have to have pure oil. So the whole miracle was an expression of Hashem's love, giving us something we didn't even need at that point. It was like a frosting on the cake. By the way, I'm not sure if I mentioned this last week, a lot of people have a misperception. The menorah has to be lit every evening. In other words, you can't, there's people, I think a lot of people think, you know, they lit the Hanukkah menorah, they lit the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash the night of the 25th of Kislev, and it burns continuously for 8 days. That wouldn't be true. Every single night you have to put it out and relight it. So in effect, they lit the menorah 8 times, but the miracle was that the oil never diminished. Yeah,
I don't know if you're ending before getting to the deal, next time. Having said what we said about Malchus coming from Yehuda,
we also know that you're talking with B'nai Rachel, who deal with Amalek. How is that element of dealing with Amalek separate from the whole concept of a leader?
Right. We think we talked about this last week. I don't remember, but we did mention that the B'nai Rachel do have one royal role, and that is the B'nai Rachel are responsible for the eradication of Amalek. That is why there was a Malchus Shol to begin with. Why did Hashem want Malchus to come from Shol, who's from Binyamin? The answer is to kill Amalek, eradicate Amalek. That is why the war of Amalek in the Midbar was led by Yehoshua from the Shevet Ephraim. That is why Mordechai from the Shevet Binyamin, Rachel, is the one who tries to defeat Haman from Amalek, right? Mordechai versus Haman is a reprise of Shaul versus Agag, and that is why there's a Mashiach ben Yosef before there's a Mashiach ben David.
And why is there a need to split?
We actually mentioned this last week, just to mention very quickly. The basic idea is the Gemara tells us that Amalek can only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not Leah. Part of it goes back to the fact that all the B'nai Leah bow down to Esav in Yaakov's encounter with Esav, and they acknowledge it. Part of it is that Esav has the spiritual merit of Kibbut Aviyim, which none of the B'nai Leah have, because they sold Yosef and brought pain to their father, etc. You know, so there are different cheshbonos that are given. But the concept is that Malchus Beis David comes on the scene only if Amalek is eradicated. And that is why Malchus Beis David, and even in David HaMelech's time, was not complete, because Shaul did not complete the job. In other words, had Shaul completed the job, Mashiach, David would have been the Mashiach. He actually is a Mashiach, but that would have been the final Geula at that particular point. But Yad al Kase Ka, as long as there's Amalek, there is a hand on the throne of Hashem that prevents the complete Hiskalus, the complete revelation of Malchus based on it. Now, all of this was kind of a digression. I don't remember what the main point was here. I'm sorry, say again. Well, it does not say in the bracha that Esav will be destroyed. It talks about Yaakov having an ultimate ascendancy and rulership over Esav.
So, but here we're all talking about that there might not be a
Okay, now I didn't say until Esav is eradicated. I said Amalek. Now Amalek is a grandson of Esav, but it's one particular nation. Esav
will still be around.
Although in the Haftorah we read last week, which is the Haftorah from the Sefer Avadji, it does talk about Esav being Kash. It describes Vaya base Yosef Esh, that the house of Yosef shall be a fire, and base Esav will be Kash, which will be stubble and be destroyed. But nevertheless, that means their power as a nation will be destroyed. It does not have to mean every individual. And remember, we have converts from Edom, and in fact the Gemara says you can even have a ger from Amalek. An amazing thing. An Amaleki can convert. It says that B'nai Banav Shel Haman. Right, Haman's children were killed, but apparently he had grandchildren. That descendants of Haman taught Torah in B'nai Brak. That's what it says in B'nai Brak. So we are Makabel Gerim. In fact, I'll just end with this thought, because the Chayla is the Chayla. We're Makabel Gerim from all over the place. We're Makabel Gerim from Amalek, if they're sincere. We're Makabel Gerim from the seven nations of Canaan. Yeah. Well, that's a well-known question. We know that Rashi quotes the Medrash that says that Dina was raped by Shechem because Yaakov concealed her from Esav. Now let me ask you the question. What's going on here? I have a daughter, and there's this awful Russia that wants to marry my daughter, so I'm going to be punished because I don't want the Shidduch to go through. In other words, how can you possibly condemn Yaakov for doing it? So there are different answers that are given. One answer is that Dina was such a tzedekes that indeed Yaakov should have realized she could have changed even Esav around. In other words, which most of us can't make that judgment. But the Balei Musar say is a little different. The Balei Musar say
Yaakov keeping Dina from Esav is totally appropriate. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what you do. But Yaakov had a certain personal... What do they say? He slammed the box too shut, too hard. Meaning, it goes back to doing it L'shem Shemaim. If he's doing it because indeed this is not a good thing, that's proper. But if he's doing it because, you see, I beat my brother yet another time, that little element of personal satisfaction HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats as a very big avera. So what Yaakov, his behavior is proper. It's like Davin and Bathsheba in a way. The behavior is halachically okay, but there was a certain motivation that's improper. But let me just end with the stuff though. So we have Gerim from all over the place. Even Esav and Amalek and the seven nations of Canaan were given a chance to convert, etc. And yet, the only nation who, even if they convert, were not allowed to intermarry with are Ammon and Moab. Now you might think, gee, is Ammon and Moab worse than Amalek? On one level they're not, because for Kerit, Amalek was supposed to kill if they don't convert, Ammon and Moab we leave alone, right? And yet we treat them even worse. Now what was the sin of Ammon and Moab? They didn't give us water when we went through the desert. But Amalek tried to kill us. Ammon and Moab did not try to kill us. So why is Ammon and Moab so condemned, even more so than Amalek? Right. So you see an important lesson here. Amalek is the personification of evil. But Rav Chaim Shmulevitz points out, it's an evil in which we have some parts. What was the story of Amalek? Amalek was the child of Timnah. Timnah was a woman who wanted to marry into Avram's family, and she was expelled. She was told she was not good enough. So she figured, if I can't marry into Avraham Avinu's family, I'll marry into Esav's family. That way I'm somewhat related. And she became a pilegesh, a mate, a concubine, a maidservant to Eliphaz, the son of Esav. And the union of that, the child of that union, was Amalek. And on one level, Timnah was said to be almost a righteous woman on some level, because she was willing to become a lowly concubine, because she wanted some attachment to Avram's family, even the bad branch, so to speak. And Avraham Shmulevitz used to say that Amalek is the product of rejection. That when a person is given the message, you're not good enough, you don't belong, go somewhere else, the pain that they feel can produce Amalek. So Amalek looks at us and tries to destroy us. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, as long as they persist in their evil ways, you have to get rid of them. But if indeed they want to do tshuva, you accept them. Don't reject them. Because then you'll be compounding the very phenomenon that resulted in Amalek in the first place. With Ammon and Moab, it's exactly the opposite. Ammon and Moab, who of course come from Lot. Now remember, it's very interesting. We're not marked them because of the incest. In other words, the Torah does not say that whatsoever. I mean, that happened. That is not the reason. But the reason is because they showed us indifference. Not even active cruelty. They didn't kill us. They didn't hurt us. They refused to help us, in spite of the kindness that Avraham Avinu showed Lot. And what we see from here is that the cruelty of the murderer who acts as a result of rejection is on some moral level not as evil as the indifference of the person who does not exhibit the characteristic of Hakara Satov, of gratitude. Amalek has no reason to have Hakara Satov to us. I mean, Esav lost the bracha, so there's no particular reason for Esav to feel Hakara Satov to Yaakov. But there's all the reason in the world for Ammon and Moab to feel HaKara Satov for Bnei Yisrael. So you see Ad Kedei Kach that we find that if a person does not have the midah of HaKara Satov, it might be a sign that the person, you have to be Baldek whether the person is Jewish. Because the outstanding midah of a Jew, you know, the famous three are Rachmanim, to be compassionate, Baishanim is humble, Gomle Chasadim, and a person who wants to do acts of loving kindness. There is a fourth meter that's mentioned in other Chazals of Hakara Satov for the goodness. And That, so you see this, as you pointed out, you see this in the lesson of Amun and Moab. But Amun and Moab, we don't hurt, we don't get rid of, but we stay away. They're considered to be a virus that can infiltrate. And the truth is, you know, again, one of the manifold nisyonos of modern society, with the abundance of toys and goodies and everything else, is that it's harder for children in particular, for adults too, to feel a sense of gratitude for smaller things, because there's so many bigger things that are constantly available and constantly being offered. You know, you bring somebody a cheap toy, you know, what about, you know, that. But it's something that's very, very pernicious. We have to be very careful about HaKoros HaTov. The Mefreshim say that is why Kibud Aviyeh is in the, you know, the first five Dibros are Bein Adam L'Makom, and the second five are Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. So people ask the Kasha, why is Kibud Aviyeh in the first list? Because Kibud Aviyeh seems to be Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, human beings, interpersonal. And the answer is that the Yisod of Kibud Aviyeh is HaKoros HaTov, right? We honor our parents because they gave us life and took care of us. And even if a parent, the only thing a parent did for you is cause your birth, that's also HaKoros HaTov, even if nothing else is right. And the Yisod is that HaKoros HaTov is such an element necessary for Avodas Hashem, that if one does not have the need of HaKoros HaTov to their human parents, they cannot serve Hashem properly. So that's HaKoros HaTov. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. I have to say, unfortunately, that, well, not unfortunately, I...